The title of this evening's sermon is this: When Faith, Hope, and Love Become Toxic. When Faith, Hope, and Love Become Toxic. Now, I hope I'm not being self-indulgent here. Preparing this sermon, it could be argued, may have performed a cathartic function for myself, though I trust the Lord might yet bring some help to more people than just myself through it. Because the general election results have certainly given us all something to think about and pray about. So please forgive me calling this snap sermon, which you perhaps had not been expecting. But there are sometimes events that are so big that we just have to stop and ponder them and allow them to intrude into what we might call the normal preaching program. For I think it is fair to say, as I'm sure all of us feel, that Thursday's election results was momentous. Comment out there is running fast and furious and will for a long, long time to come. But we, of course, have a more coherent and intellectually satisfying context to help us than the world of political commentators, match of the day commentators, and celebrity Twitter users, to mention a few. We are Christians, most of us. We are in relationship with a great God who has given us an inerrant book and the help of his Spirit, who has given us minds, reasoning faculties, and feelings besides. We have some massive advantages. We're not saddled with the intellectual deadweight of atheism, and instead we are able to reflect, ponder before God with the Bible open before us to see what it has to say to us at this time. But one thing is certain. Whatever the arguments about deficiencies of particular candidates and particular campaigns and particular manifestos, which have their time and place when they're not here, one thing is as true today as it was yesterday or will be tomorrow. Psalm 115, verse 3. But our God is in heaven. He does whatever he pleases. Or as Nebuchadnezzar, freshly restored to his kingdom, put it, as we have it in Daniel chapter 4, in verses 34 to 35. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" That is the background to our lives, the lives of politicians, political parties, nations, peoples, continents. Now, none of what follows remotely pretends to have some infallible authority, as though I was in possession of the Lord's counsel. We'll be drawing lessons from these events like everybody else for a long time to come, and our thinking will develop as we travel along, and some things at least may become clearer. There is more, then, by way of personal anecdote that we might usually be accustomed to. Anecdotes that may not seem to have an immediate spiritual context, although I hope it will become clear that they do. Plus, there are observations on past political events and political parties, certainly more than usually would be expected or indeed proper in a sermon. This is risky stuff, and it may tread on some toes. There are names of particular personalities, coupled with an attempted assessment of what might be happening in and through them and why. This is close to the knuckle. But I think the behaviour of some of these people, their bearing towards Christians and our God, merit more than polite silence on our part and instead must submit to the scrutiny of the Bible. I am not the discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. But there are behaviours people have indulged in observable over a long period of time that simply cannot remain unaddressed, I think, and invite our evaluation with our Bibles open before us. But again, though a lot of it may seem to be politics, I hope this will help us understand what, perhaps, the Lord might be showing us, saying to us, and more generally, doing in the nation. We are, I believe, called to think. That thinking may need to take us into some areas we're not familiar with, or might not think appropriate. I offer the thought that we need to be quite tough in our thinking, going where the evidence takes us, even if it leads us to some unhappy conclusions and to some solemn reflections. But I think the times demand it of us. Sons of Issachar, we are told, had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. 1 Chronicles chapter 12 and verse 32. It is our responsibility before God as Christians to try to know the times ourselves and consider what Israel ought to do. So we will return to Joseph and Jacob and his dealings with his sons next week, the Lord permitting. Well, they say, don't they, that a week is a long time in politics. It certainly is. A cartoon in the newspapers from last year after the Brexit result and what followed had two soon-to-be students talking together. The one was saying to the other that he was going to be studying politics, and his chosen era from history was the period from 9 o'clock Monday morning to 3 o'clock Thursday afternoon. I did not stay up all night Thursday night. In the 2015 general election, the exit polls from different polling stations predicted the election result just about spot on. So soon as the polling stations closed at 10 p.m, an instant later, the broadcasters would make known the predictions. They duly did, and told my family, me, everything we needed to know. Waking to the news in the morning, the predictions were more or less precisely fulfilled. So I went to bed on Thursday evening, knowing what I had really known for a long time, but had now had startlingly confirmed to me that I was a stranger in a foreign country. You see, we're not so far from Genesis 49 and 50 after all. We are God's people in Egypt. Canaan is our home, heaven. We're not to forget it. Our first thought, then, is a very obvious point, and one which most, if not all of us, have worked out already. We are a nation experiencing the grave displeasure of a mighty and holy God. In other words, we are a nation under judgment. Those judgments are varied, as I hope to illustrate. There are slower action ones that work away quietly but powerfully. Their effects are seen through time or become clearer as the result of particular events or people's responses to them. Indeed, these judgments may not be obvious to their recipients, but they are to us because the Bible helps us to recognize the signs. Thursday's results bring us examples of this, as we shall see. Other judgments come more as a thunderclap and are striking, immediate, more spectacular, and directly targeted. This latter kind of judgment has, I think we have to conclude, been visited upon the Conservative Party and on our Prime Minister in particular. I do not say that because I believe the Conservative Party represents some equivalent of a moral majority like in America, and that any setback it receives, therefore, must be a sign of the Lord departing from our land. It used to be said that the Church of England was the Conservative Party at prayer, as though the party and its spiritual proxy, the bastions of true religion, defenders of the faith, promoters of true virtue and morality, the backbone of our nation, and that some backward step in either of their fortunes would signal the end of civilization as we know it. Both those institutions, by and large, have long since ceased to function in that capacity, if indeed they ever did. But we return to them in a moment. Neither should we think, if we are tempted so to do, that success for the Labour Party, Thursday's results has certainly been that for the party, and in particular for its leader, Mr. Corbyn, that this stands as the bellwether of all things terrible, as though the party's progress was a sure indication to us that all was going badly, as though if Jeremy Corbyn got a better than expected showing, well, we should expect the Antichrist the following week. Nothing so easy, nothing so dramatic. We do well to remember this. The Labour Party's origins were tied up with Methodism, of a kind I think we would find a great deal of sympathy with. There were great men and women of great heart who were genuinely moved with the appalling conditions that so many families and working people had to experience. We owe them, as a nation, a great debt. But the Methodism has long since gone, and those days of chapel influence with it. That came home to me in 1985, in the days when, some of you remember all this, I'm sure, when the proceedings of the Labour Party conference, and indeed of all the main parties, were broadcast live on BBC One and BBC Two. It just about beat watching paint dry to observe the proceedings of the Labour conference and its members being exhorted to get behind such strangely titled things as Composite Motion 386. The day of union block votes, the militant tendency, and Bennites. But one event still stands out in my mind. It stood out when I watched it then. It stands out still. One morning, there was a resolution to be discussed that sought specific recognition for a group of homosexual people working within the wider labour movement. In those days, before these conferences became much more stage-managed, anybody could come up to the microphone to speak. On this occasion of this particular debate, as I recall him, an elderly Welshman stepped up to the mic. I don't know his name or who he was. I could probably guess he was from the Welsh Valleys, somewhere like that. He was not a public speaker. It was maybe the first time he had spoken at conference. It would probably be his last. What he did articulate, by shouting, but if my memory serves me rightly, with a tone of pained sadness, was that he felt that homosexuality was basically not natural. He did not develop much of an argument. I even think he was close to tears as he pleaded with conference, using this straightforward argument that he had to hand. But as he spoke, there were boos and hisses coming from some present in the hall. It showed us where the party was going, the kind of people that it was attracting. I do not know what happened to the man who spoke that morning. I wondered from time to time. Maybe he was Methodism's last hurrah. I don't know. As I recall it, the motion was passed. But it told you where the boundaries of acceptable and unacceptable speech in the party lay, and that there were people willing to intimidate and bully to impose their so-called progressive, anti-Christian views. Sadly, I have to report that things have stayed pretty much the same with the Labour Party ever since. Some of you may recall a series I did 4 years ago on so-called cultural Marxism and how New Labour brought opposition to the Christian faith into the mainstream of political opinion and embedded it in the political establishment. I'll not repeat the material again here, though I think it is highly relevant. Getting quite personal here, the selection of Mr. Corbyn as leader, with his raft of unpalatable views and unsavoury friendships, from a Christian perspective, could well be interpreted as being the Lord's judgment on the Labour Party. The undoubted offence they have caused God seemed perhaps to have served them up, with a leader likely to lead them to spectacular defeat in the election, as he was generally considered to be unelectable. His continuing presence at the helm of the party might yet prove this, but as we know from Thursday evening, it was not to be implemented upon the party through a disaster at the ballot box, at least not this time round. He may yet be the instrument the Lord uses to punish the nation at large. Only time will tell. But now back to the Conservative Party and the indicted humiliation they have suffered. Again, a little history. Now, a previous Conservative administration had put in place what was called Section 28, 1988 Local Government Act. The effect of this was to prevent the active promotion of homosexual lifestyles as a valid option in schools. New Labour, when it came into office, removed Section 28 in 2003. But at the Conservative Party conference in 2002, the then party chairman announced the party was moving away from the tag of being the nasty party, a kind of party that might have introduced something like a Section 28, and was looking to be friendlier towards people it had previously been seen to be hostile to. I heard the speech with interest and realised things were changing in the Conservative Party, and that things like Section 28 would not be coming back anytime soon if they were in power. The name of the party chairman back in 2002, nearly 15 years ago, was Theresa May. From that announced sea change, which apparently left the conference room stunned, according to some media reports, a new mood arose in the party that eventually made gay marriage enter the statute books, which then Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron described as something he was doing not in spite of being a Conservative, but because he was a Conservative. He was telling us, in effect, you see, it is real, we are not the nasty party. His sudden and unexpected demise post the Brexit vote last June must be taken on the Lord's verdict on the party's rebranding efforts. Zeal for these things could also be gauged from the high number of practising homosexuals now to be found within the ranks of the cabinet and holding other junior ministerial positions. And then the Conservative response to Muslim extremism and hate speech turned out to be a proposal to have what were called Extremist Disruption Orders, EDOs. These were announced in September 2014. We were told there would be a crackdown on people whose views might not necessarily lead to violence, as with jihadists, but who could still be thought to sow division and hatred in society. We realise there are some people who speak very unkindly and wrongly about people whose behaviours are offensive to God. We may disagree profoundly with people, but we do it with compassion, and ideally with tears. But the fact remains that the term extremism was so loosely defined that we could well imagine ourselves being caught in its mesh if we, in a measured and loving way, opposed, say, gay marriage, or were negative about Islam. Learned QCs looking at the proposed legislation bore out that concern. The name of the then Home Secretary responsible for this proposal, of course, was one Theresa May. To boot, she also banned some people from coming from the United States to speak about the dangers of Islam, or being very tolerant to the comings and goings of foreign hate preachers and imams, plus other people with known jihadist sympathies slipping in and out of the country under the noses of border security. As Prime Minister, she appointed a woman who in June 2016 declared herself to be in a happy same-sex relationship to be Education Secretary. You might be expected to very much keep alive the idea of Ofsted coming into churches, teaching children, and shutting down their work if they failed to teach British values, which have been largely reduced to meaning supporting gay sex and gay marriage. So I'm not so sure I trusted her instincts on some matters of key relevance to us as Christians. It appears the nation did not trust her sufficiently either. We've often spoken at prayer meeting with a little dark humour about how we are still waiting, after nearly 3 years, to learn if we, as Christians, are extremists or not. We've smiled about it. We're long-suffering British. We graciously smile at the insults to us and cheerfully get on. I guess actually it's our proper response as Christians. However, I think the initial proposal and the failure to conclusively rule out Christians being extremists was not appreciated in a much higher court. The Searcher of Hearts had some strong views about the vicar's daughter and her treatment of his people. If she is wise, she might review some of the above, for I think she has been at the receiving end of a hefty rebuke from heaven. So judgments have abounded. Individuals, perhaps parties, have found their best laid plans upended. True is the proverb, First one to plead his cause seems right, until his neighbour comes and examines him. Proverbs 16, verse 17. The examining can be very brutal, and at times very unfair. And if the first to plead his cause does a fairly lacklustre job in the first place, then things can unravel. I'm not sure where they go from here, or Mrs. May in particular. We did not end up with a coalition of chaos. We simply ended up with the chaos. Or at least not quite. Is it not remarkable that the party in the United Kingdom that most explicitly espouses Christian convictions and morality, the Democratic Unionist Party from Northern Ireland, has been catapulted into prominence as the votes of its 10 members are now needed by Mrs. May to secure a working majority and form a government? My imagination can run riot at times, but is it not wonderful to think that a party that wants to keep Northern Ireland clear of gay marriage and abortion now has the Prime Minister's ear? Might we not even think that this may have some good implications for the Ashers Baking Company, owned by the MacArthur family in Belfast? We recall how their Christian demeanour, conduct and general witness under immense duress and provocation has been an inspiration to us all. They have, I'm sure we all know, suffered legal penalties because they declined to bake a cake bearing a pro-gay marriage slogan. Their case is to be heard in the Supreme Court of Northern Ireland this autumn. The outcome is by no means certain, and may be as disappointing as previous hearings have been. The DUP have been vocal champions of the MacArthurs. It brings some comfort to my simple mind to think the MacArthurs' main political advocates now have the attention of the Prime Minister. How remarkable. But the political situation is very fragile nonetheless. Mrs. May's clout with Brussels and the forthcoming Brexit negotiations has suffered massively from the wounds inflicted on Thursday last week. And that we have to accept as the decision from the Lord. We have prayed that his kingdom would come and his will be done. This is what it looks like. Confusion, implications for Brexit unclear, possibility of another general election sometime soon, people divided, the younger generation separated from their elders, communities looking at each other in bewilderment. I think all of that is the judgment of God for a nation that has abandoned him wholesale, has defied his laws, that dismisses preachers of the gospel and open-air witness, that does not think it worth the bother of entering a place of worship unless it be for a birth, marriage, or death. It is a society whose opinion formers happily champion a religion, Islam, that speaks ill of our God and of his Son. We should never think that God watches idly by. He will not be mocked. Our judgment has not been sleeping. So we find ourselves as a nation, left discomforted, the future uncertain, likely deals over trade with the EU or whatever, in the balance as we survey the scene at this moment. Let me be a little controversial and outspoken on this. I personally believe that the Brexit vote last year was a deliverance, or at least an opportunity for a deliverance. I know not all of us voted for it, but I think it was an unexpected gift from heaven. It was completely undeserved. A window of opportunity to ask ourselves who we were and who we ought to be. Did we appreciate it? Did our nation reflect on it? Did we ask ourselves where we were going and what kind of nation we wanted to be? Did those who voted Brexit last year really ask themselves about our identity in the future? Was a lot of it just a grump against all authority with a fair slice of racism thrown in for good measure? Whatever was in people's hearts last Thursday's vote makes you seriously wonder what sort of future, if any, they envision. I fear that the window of opportunity that Brexit gave us may have been squandered. And if so, then that is a judgment of God. It may be lifted in due course, but it seems to be very much in operation at the moment. So there have been judgments of various kinds, I think. Some sudden and quite personal. others more national, far-reaching in their scope. We come now belatedly to my title per se. This toxic faith, hope, and love. For here we see the judgment on our nation that has been working over perhaps decades, and whose effects, I fear, were most clearly revealed by the voting patterns in this general election. But this is the remarkable thing that we have discovered about our nation. The amazing faith, hope, and love that the last 4 weeks of electioneering and campaigning have uncovered. But of what kind? These great virtues, of course, sit there as the crown jewels at the end of the mighty 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians. Here is some context. Gone are the tongues, gone are the prophecies, gone are the special revelations so treasured by the church and used as the yardstick to measure closeness to God and allocate special status to people. But all the things they relied upon to make them feel good were going, I think going soon. They would find themselves suddenly deprived of their spiritual supports and comforts. So they're to dig deeper now and nurture the virtues which God prized. Faith, hope, and love, these three. For their faith seems to have been in their gifted status, their hope in this exalted situation going on to their last days on earth, and their love was non-existent towards others, though lavished in abundance on themselves. That which was going to remain would be exactly that in which they were at the time of Paul writing, massively deficient. In fact, this status-seeking, look at me, I'm a gifted tongue speaker kind of approach is rebuked as speaking as a child, understanding as a child, thinking as a child. We're to become men. Leave these attitudes, childish ways, proud bits of attention-seeking behind. We have to grow up. That is the point Paul is making. I'm not talking about being a man when we get to heaven, but being a man now. We are to be mature and graduate to the possession of the enduring qualities that go with spiritual adulthood, faith, hope, and love. Each of us, if we are Christians, are to be travelling in that direction. We're to be getting a better grounding in our trust for the Lord, our hope of glory, and our willingness to offer the kind of love that we have in verses 4-7, which I shall read again. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Not tongue speaking, nor prophesying, not displays of the supernatural, but the possession of faith, hope, and love is the sign of progress. It's a good question to ask ourselves today. Where are our hopes? Soft Brexit, hard Brexit, customs union, free trade area, or heaven? Who is our faith in? Politicians who can get it horribly wrong? Messianic political figures, who, according to a poem written in honour of this particular leader, stole into our hearts and lit a candle? Or the Son of Man, who passed without sin or error through this world and to the cross to die for his people? Do we have faith in the British electorate and trust them to get the right answer? Or do we look to the infinitely wise and powerful God who knows the future where we are yet to go? Do we hope armed soldiers on our streets will preserve us from the jihadist's murderous car rampage? Or is our confidence in the Lord who made heaven and earth? Do we confess we are but pilgrims and strangers on earth, and that we account our highest achievements will wither away to next to nothing in the light of eternity? Do we have some childish things we need to give up? Immature ideas, thoughts that do not sit well with people who espouse the Christian faith and confess they have no continuing home here on earth. We need to believe in a grown-up God who does actually deliver judgments, even on public figures, and who is jealous for the honour of his name. We need a greater God than one who is not much more than a soothing comforter to nurse our pains and read us sweet stories where they all lived happily ever after. Oh, sure, they will in glory. We all will. That is the solid and mature Christian hope and the faith we have. But on earth, when the apostles and noble band of martyrs went to their deaths, sometimes so heroically, the God who sustained them is the same God who holds us through what the world would account to be very unhappy endings. Or did someone switch the God of the Bible for some weaker version? Through sadness, disappointment, no growth, loss of tenants, loss of income, neuralgia, chronic conditions, badly behaving people, he leads us safely on, doesn't he? So the response from us needs to have this about us. 1 Corinthians 16, verses 13 to 14, watch, stand fast in the faith, be brave, be strong, let all you do be done with love. Let's apply something of this, then, to the wider population. People have voted in what I think we have to accept has been a most extraordinary way. A man with a remarkable track record in giving comfort to IRA bombers, terrorists, Muslim extremists, haters of Israel, and with an ideological pedigree that has embraced vintage hardline communists like Leon Trotsky and Fidel Castro, and who has surrounded himself with colleagues who do the same, who has a passion promoting all forms of unbiblical sexuality, keen on abortion, and whose ideas on defense and the economy at best can be described as wildly optimistic, has come within an ace of heading up the government of the United Kingdom. According to one assessment looking at marginal seats and how it might have slightly changed here and there, it only needed something like 2,227 votes to have been cast differently, and then he would have been in position to form a government. Why it is not impossible to imagine a scenario emerging over the next 6 months where he could actually end up being Prime Minister. And the young people, among others, have lapped it all up. I travelled with Andrew to hear Jeremy Corbyn one August midweek afternoon last year in the Labour leadership contest when he spoke in the park in Matlock. I think he has one speech, but he gives it well. At the end, his loyal supporters stood up to applaud him with real love and admiration in their eyes. Just as the Toronto blessing hit the churches 23 years ago, causing normally sane and sensible people to fall over, laugh hysterically, bark like dogs, moo like cows, we've had a new wave of political fervour, the Corbyn blessing, or the Islington anointing, that has swept through large swathes of our society, especially among our young people. It has been a remarkable phenomenon, akin to a piece of revivalism. The Toronto blessing spread quickly as a result of the internet, which was then in its infancy. Now, with the immensely more sophisticated social media available to hand, the Corbyn blessing has swept many away. Comment on and defences of Mr. Corbyn's track record have been hungrily devoured. Young people have posted photos of themselves with the man himself, selfies and the kind, or shared pictures of themselves in the man's vicinity. It was curious to have told us of the dramatic impact upon himself when the Lord looked up and saw him in the sycamore tree on that famous day in Jericho. We could well understand that. Jeremy Corbyn? Really? Extraordinary. Just as Bernie Sanders, the 75-year-old US senator, nearly stole the hearts of the young voters away from Hillary Clinton in the Democratic Party primaries. Feel the burn, was the saying for the enthusiasm he was generating as this septuagenarian brand of hard-left stuff inspired the young and nearly cut Hillary's nomination bid dead. Jeremy, as a name, perhaps offers fewer helps and hints for a catchy title than Bernie. Never mind, maybe with a bit of help from one of footballing stars of yesteryear, Gazza, that locker room kind of stuff, and so Jezza has caught on beautifully. And we're left speechless by it all, not a little horrified. I expect parents of teenage daughters, when the Beatles were in their pomp, had something of this when they saw their normally staid girls shouting and screaming, fainting and the like at the appearance of the less than fab four. Now, we do well to note, as I mentioned a few years back with cultural Marxism, that none of the above political fervour has much time for the Christian faith, for the family, for traditional marriage, respect for the Bible over and above the Quran. No. Rather, in the analysis routinely offered in those circles, the Bible, patriarchy, male-only pastors, exclusive claims to truth, have been indissolubly linked with capitalism and colonialism, with subjugating, oppressing, and the spurring on of violence, the creating of bigotry, hatred, separation, producing exclusion, not inclusion. There is little sympathy in those circles for the Bible's claims, and instead plenty of opposition against it. Which is why this quite political stuff is the subject matter for a sermon rather than simply belonging in a lecture on political and social trends today. What is going on here has implications for us as Christians. This is where we come down hard. Going back to Paul, his implicit assumption is that his readers will grow out of childish thinking and reasoning and be happy to do so. What if they, or we, are not? What if we arrest the process of growing up? What if we halt it so that we stay speaking as a child, thinking as a child, reasoning as a child? So instead of developing powers of critical reasoning, dispassionate searching out the truth, we stayed happy with little slogans and superficial ideas and stories. So instead of learning to think, to go where the evidence takes us, to assess according to a thought-out moral framework, to be consistent and logical in thought, to preserve an ability to react strongly against clear injustice and evil, like acts of terror, the persecution of Christians, what if those features of adulthood never emerge? Instead, how about if we had no structured and coherent ethical and moral framework, that we assess things according to how we felt about them, whether they were entertaining and made us laugh, were fronted by good-looking people with good style? What if we were less interested in details and facts and more interested in clever put-downs and witty comments, smart use of technology or the like? Or if we were to like things that tell us a story, a narrative, if you will, that skates over inconvenient details, rewrites a bit of history on the way, has some good comic book goodies and some baddies, and offers you a place among the company of the righteous, provided you conform to the rules if you want to stay in my gang and be friends with me. We'd be tempted to say that this way of going about things was a bit, well, childish, uncritical, stupidly tribal, and quite unsuited to grown-up debate and analysis. Yet I offer this for our contention, that this is actually where a lot of thinking and reasoning and understanding is presently marooned. It's a case of arrested development, where thinking and reasoning and understanding among supposedly intelligent people is infantile, childish, puerile. Look at the humour, or what passes for it today. How often it is basically smutty, distinctly unfunny. People in their 40s and 50s still chortle at comedians when the humour descends to the lavatorial, or when they swear for effect, how they laugh. Or at the reaction of some, if their reasoning is challenged, how they rage. Like children, they throw a temper tantrum, threaten to unfriend us if we disagree, or to throw us out of their gang for not thinking, reasoning, and understanding like them. But that is our world today. That is the world of much that is laughingly called social media, much of which is downright unsocial. Reading in the Daily Telegraph, some body who had been in the Great British Bake Off, sounding off against celebrity chefs that they weren't speaking out against the Conservatives and speaking up their support for Jeremy Corbyn. And she had some very choice words to say to them. And how much in this campaign been downright abusive that people have been saying that if you voted Conservative, I dare not tell you what they said about you if that was you. That's how it works, intimidating people to stay loyal. That does not seem very grown up to me. That is from the world of the playground bully, not the stuff of grown-ups, I would have thought. But that is us. I'm sorry to have to report this, but it is the world of much academia. Universities are less places for freedom of thought and speech and inquiry, and are now to be sanctuaries for people who, like children, cannot quite deal with the real world of differing opinions. Angry words, weird theories, achingly dull servings of political correct thought become the stuff of so many departments and courses in the social sciences and the humanities. The students never grow up because their lecturers have never grown up. But let's take this further still. Paul speaks of faith, hope, and love, these three. These are the badges of adulthood, of maturity, the possession of which are good signs that we have left childish things behind. However, we must take seriously the possibility that they're almost polar opposites to those whose thinking never matures, who never grow up. That the alternative to the true Christian variety of faith, hope, and love is a counterfeit, phony, empty, unspiritual one. G.K. Chesterton is not our guide in theology, but we must acknowledge a wise saying when we hear it. For he's coined the phrase that when a man ceases to believe in God, he does not believe in nothing, he believes in anything. He'll put his faith in anything. He will entertain wild, extravagant, and unreasonable hopes. Faith and hope, but not in God and his promises, emphatically not. And love? Yes, there is love as well, both in its expression and in the object that is viewed with affection. But it is a form of love that attaches itself to unreasonable things and people, a love for what can be unlovely and plain wrong. I think we're seeing this happen today. Most of society, especially what we might call white society, has jettisoned a thoughtful biblical worldview, able to give structure and coherence to our moral values and asserting the place of truth and reason. After all, God himself has spoken in words, reasoning with us. His own Son declared himself to be the truth. When men, as in Romans chapter 1, verse 28, decide not to retain God in their knowledge, the ground is clear for false faith, false hope, and false love, toxic varieties to fill the void. And the cementing in place of this toxic, unbiblical, and anti-God trio actually becomes the evidence that God has given us over to a debased mind, Romans 1, verse 28, or to the process we find described in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 9 to 12, the coming the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this reason, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. Pleasure in unrighteousness. A false love for what is evil. Not receiving the love of the truth. So, unrighteous deception and strong delusion come down to cement the rebel in infantile thinking, reacting, and understanding. It makes its sufferer hold even more tenaciously to the object of its love. Messianic figure, the tellers of the happy story with a happy ending for all. Katy Perry, the pop singer, suggested at the Manchester concert to commemorate the dead that we reach out and touch our neighbour so that love will conquer evil. Some love it is that winks at injustice, that denies grieving people closure, which offers the hope of an answer, which will be laughable were not for the fact that people take it seriously. A gush of sentiment, an empty gesture, a flush of virtue that we're lovers, not haters, and we cleave to the narrative that will all turn out fine. And going back to the sermon the other week, that the Islamist leopard really will lie down with the gender-fluid ox and eat straw together. The approaches that go with this love fly in the face of the grown-up variety, which is the stuff of the mature Christian faith. This love is often anything but what verses 4 to 7 express. This love will not suffer long, and be kind if you dare to differ on any particular point and hold an independent view. This love does parade itself, is puffed up, and does behave very rudely. It is easily provoked. It's only too quick to think evil of people that differ from it. It rejoices massively in iniquity, and has little real interest in the truth. Its capacity to bear all things and believe the best about people is very limited. And its hopes are strictly reserved for unrealistic and fantasy stuff. And again, you may find the love on offer quickly fails on you if you do not conform.
So there is a parallel world
of faith, hope, and love for the non-religious. The God-haters, atheists, self-styled agnostics, humanists, and secularists. They are hoping for a promised land here on earth with gay marriage, multiculturalism, and where sentimental, gushing love is available on tap for those who conform to the list of acceptable things to love and the equivalent list of acceptable things to hate. It is love buoyed along by the music, the hope kept burning by foundational ballads like John Lennon's Imagine, faith that finds fresh people and objects to fix upon to get us to the promised land. I think many people, including many young people, have shown themselves to be in this spiritual state and are manifesting the traits of being under God's judgment. They reject Jesus Christ and edge close to believing that Jeremy Corbyn is the Messiah they need, along with the free stuff he gives away. Incredible. But I think this general election supplies evidence to make the assertion credible. And at risk of repeating myself from last time, they are sheep without a shepherd. They are angry sheep. Sheep following the voices of unhelpful strangers, promising them unlimited grass in lands where the grass will always be greener. And there are plenty of takers. It is a gullible age that abandons God and believes in anything. It is a fantasy world which those under judicial, strong delusion are likely to buy into. The end of it? Eternal ruin, ultimately. And it means the degradation of character, morals, reasoning skills, and compassion in the meantime. Liberties that ensure our progress and development, such as freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, suffer loss. It is a love for some neighbours, but actually tangible hate for others. It wears the cloak of virtue while lashing opponents with all that only the most loving, tolerant, and peace-loving of hearts can muster. And the inconsistencies, larger and smaller hypocrisies, warped moral judgments, are excused and never inquired into any more than a child would overly worry about being consistent or logical. If it makes you laugh, has style or good music, if it takes a swipe at God and traditional morality, then it must be good. And so the victim of this severe malady limps through life, hating the very one who can offer sure remedy and relief, the one who loves wandering and lost sheep and went out to tenderly rescue them at immense personal cost. But will they listen? Will they turn aside? Will they wake up from their slumber, shake off this childishness, repent of their false faith, false hope, and false love? We stand ready with tears in our eyes. We tender the gospel to them, leaflets through their doors, witness to them in the open air. We plead with them. But I ask, for many of them, is it actually too late? Like Sodom and Gomorrah, have we passed the point of no return? Are those who will be spared but a small handful? Friends, we must pray for this generation. We must ask for mercy. Though we have the amazing spectacle, the most God-fearing political party in the UK now holding the balance of power, it is also fragile, the gain so slender and at risk of collapse and loss. But beyond it all, problems unearthed in our culture remain. Those problems are not going away, and we must judge them to be getting worse. It requires clear thinking from us all. It requires true faith, hope, and love in abundance. We cannot afford to be complacent, ignorant, detached. This is our nation. It is under God's judgment. We need spiritually to be at our best to make a difference.